Let's pray. Merciful God, we pray that you will continue to be Emmanuel. We need this. We want that. And how good it is when it's true. Lord, it isn't that you ever leave us, but make us aware of it. And may we also, through the reading of your scriptures, reading it together as we do, become increasingly aware of what a God it is that is ours through Jesus Christ. Bless us this morning in a study of two books that have caused much difficulty for some people, much debate. Give us one mind in Jesus Christ. Amen. I am not going to finish Jeremiah, that isn't going through a chapter by chapter, because if I did go into detail, it would take another whole hour, and it's that historical section, and if there's a repetition of the various nations that come under the judgment of God, I'd like you to notice that it said of three of them that they will continue to have a portion in the Lord, a number. That's the way the prophecy concludes concerning a few of the surrounding nations of Egypt. That is not said, but in Isaiah 19 it is said that Israel will be the third amongst the people that are called God's people, Assyria and Egypt, and are the other two that are mentioned. But Jeremiah does not mention them as those having a portion with the Lord. We're not finished with Jeremiah, however. Rather than spending more time with that historical section, which is a little easier to understand, I would prefer to spend this morning with the book of Lamentations. This is a book that has been omitted very much, and about the only sermon I ever heard preached from it, and I must confess the only sermon I have from Lamentations is from that middle section, that heart of the book, the great is thy faithfulness, thy mercies are new every morning, chapter 3, 21-22. But the entire book is surely worthy of our concentrated consideration. If ever there is a book of penitence, if ever there is a book of humiliation, a book of acknowledging God's righteousness in the midst of judgment, it is this book. We'll make a few introductory comments first. Jeremiah lamented over Jerusalem. And as I said before, if tears were evidence of strength and of compassion, his strength comes through, particularly in his prophecy. His compassion comes through in this section of lament and the other laments as we have seen them, as in chapter 8, chapter 9, particularly the last part of 8, the beginning of 9. The second place I want to point out to you that the Septuagint says, and that's the first translation of the Hebrew Bible, and that was into Greek. The Greek translation, which took place, this translation took place about 300 B.C., says that these laments were written about Jerusalem after Israel had been carried away captive. When Jerusalem was desolate, and Jeremiah was weeping over the city. This was the specific situation. So that means it must have been written just during that very limited period between Jerusalem being evacuated by force and the departure for Egypt, which only covered a relatively short period of time. I think this tradition has to be accepted as true until proven false. Thirdly, most biblical scholars find a traceable outline in this book of Lamentations. Very few agree on the outline, especially on certain details. All agreed on the general theme. Jerusalem is desolate because of her sin. That surely is the theme. But just how this has worked out. Isn't it amazing when you have all these words in front of you and people can't quite figure out how all these words break down into sub-thoughts? Now, I think it's Morgan that mentions this fact that many other Bible commentators have mentioned, and many people notice it too when they read. Jeremiah does not express any attitude of self-righteousness. There's nothing that he as a prophet would indicate. Look, I as a prophet told you so. Look, I'm the only true prophet after all. When he stood against all the other prophets, we call, there's none of this self-vindication that comes through. Rather, as a member of the entire community, he confesses sin, he humbles himself, and he expresses grief over the woe. Jerusalem's sin is his sin. Jerusalem's humiliation is his humiliation. Jerusalem's agony and grief is his agony and grief. And thus it always is, class, if indeed you have the right view of humanity. What happens to man happens to you, a member of the human race. And when the whole human race is afflicted, maybe one area more than another, yet all of humanity should be suffering. And this is especially true of the covenant community, the Christian community. Can there be one sick in the church and the whole church not pained? Can there be a grief in the family of a congregation and the whole church not in grief? The covenant community is one community. God deals with the individual, but always with the individual and community. And so what happens to the community as a whole happens to the individual. What happens to the one individual is always in the setting of the community. And that's what Jeremiah gives such eloquent expression to here. There is an I, me, but then he's speaking as a representative of the of the whole community. And that, in times, is very important, too, that we more or less speak in the singular, personal, first person, knowing that you are, in a way, then only speaking as a representative, as a voice of the whole community. We go to chapter 1. Jerusalem, the lonely city. And I'd like to point out, rather than go through it verse by verse, just to point out a few of these basic concepts that are repeated. There is repetition here. Jerusalem, the lonely one, she weeps with no one to comfort. Verse 2, verse 17, verse 21. No one to comfort. Verse 2, there she has none to comfort her. Among all her lovers and all her friends, they have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemy. And then in verse 17, Zion stretches out her hand. There's the agonizing one. There's like you sometimes have pictures of the famine-stricken, hungry ones, reaching with bony claws, reaching out, and there's no one to comfort her. In verse 21, they have heard that I groan. There is no one to comfort me. No one to give strength. No one to give healing. No one to put the pieces back together. For when the pieces are put together, then there is strength again. Then there's joy when things are back in shape. No one to comfort. So, note the acknowledgement of the servitude. Verse 3, Judah has gone into exile under affliction and under harsh servitude. God had delivered them from the servitude of Egypt. God had delivered them from the servitude of Egypt, from the bondage of Egypt. And they've gone right back to a harsh bondage. This is chapter 1, verse 3. Exile under affliction. And what is the affliction? To be returned to the original status of being a slave. And I tell you, we'll pick up maybe a bit of this when we read Ezekiel. Those people in Babylon, in those initial years particularly, they were put under cruel bondage, and they had to work from early till late as slaves. And it is thought, especially by those that have paid particular attention to some of the archaeological evidences that have been picked up there, that one of the major tasks that the slaves were used for were in the big irrigation projects. Today, in California, we have those great big siphon pumps that lift water. They bring the water and they can just raise it over the mountain. Great big electrical pumps, electrical motors, driving these big suction pumps that suck the water and lift it up 25, 30, 40 feet. And it's rivers of water, some of those big canals. They've got that Bryan Water Project over there. My, what a deal. Bringing the water all the way from the northern part of the state where they got way too much down to the southern part that's practically desert and made a garden out of the desert. That's what Isaiah 35 really speaks to me. But anyway, they had great water diversion projects in Babylon in Nebuchadnezzar's time. And how did they lift the water? They had whole rows of people just standing there with great big buckets on the end of a stick, scooping. They had canals that floated ships on water lifted by slaves.
They had great irrigation projects, irrigated thousands of acres evidently there. And the water all had to be lifted from the rivers and the canals. Manpower. Israel knew what it was to become a water carrier and a water lifter. That was bondage, not making bricks this time, but another age. Maybe it wasn't as hot as a brick stone. But I know those ditch banks can get mighty hot with the reflection of the water coming at you. And it feels like you got double sun on you. Any man that's gone fishing that was in use of the sun has found that out in a hurry, right? Well, this is part of that cruel bondage into which they went. So she has found no rest, verse 3. Note, in verse 4, the roads of Zion are in mourning. The roads to Zion are supposed to be roads of songs. Remember the songs of ascent from 113 to 134? As the people would go up to worship and people coming up from all the different roads, one singing this theme, another singing that theme, they're coming up to Zion with songs of praise. And what now? The roads of Zion are in mourning because no one comes to the appointed feast. Desolation, emptiness, her gates are desolate, her priests are groaning, her virgins afflicted, and she herself is bitter. Her adversaries have become her masters, her enemies prosper, for the Lord has caused her grief. No singing. The streets that should have been resounding with the songs of Zion, they are as quiet and as dead as the desert tracks. Yes, it's the Lord who has caused grief. Verse 5 I just read, and in verse 21, there's no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of it. Of my calamity, they are glad that thou hast done it. These people who talk to piety about their God, well, that their God has taken care of them good and proper. But again, it's all because of sin. We read this before. Verse 8 now. Jerusalem sinned greatly. Is it nothing to you who pass by? Look and see if there's any pain like my pain, verse 12, which was severely dealt out to me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. There it's the Lord who caused the grief because of the sin. Then in verse 14 and 15, the yoke of my transgression is bound. The Lord has rejected all my strong men in the midst. The Lord has trodden us as in a winepress. Again, the Lord causes grief because of acknowledgement. They have to acknowledge it was our sin. Notice he gives prosperity to the enemies now. When God's people go down, the enemies are prospering. But when God's people prosper, the enemies go down. Remember? That's the way it is. Now the enemies prosper, verse 5. I read that there. Her enemies prosper when the Lord causes grief to his people. The enemies prosper because he uses the enemy as a means of punishment. The riches of Jerusalem are in the hands of the enemies. That's why they are prospering, verse 10. The adversary has stretched out his hand over all her precious things. And the people of Jerusalem that should be rich are groaning, seeking bread. They're hungry. They're hungry. Who has pain like my pain? Jeremiah groaned in verse 12. The weeping, the groaning. Pain like my pain. This is incomparable. And in verse 16, for these things I weep. My eyes run down with water because far from me is a comforter. There's another reference to comfort. Why do I weep? My children are desolate because the enemy has prevailed. So you can pick up all these various themes that I've been pointing out here. No comforter, servitude, desolate. Instead of songs, there's grief. Grief brought by the Lord because of sin. Prosperity to the enemy when God's people are impoverished. Impoverished so much so that they groan in their hunger. And there's weeping. And the voice of Jerusalem in verse 20, O see, O Lord, for I am in distress. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is overturned within me. For I have been very rebellious. Notice how Jeremiah identifies himself there with the whole of the people. But in all this, notice verse 18 and 19. God is righteous. The Lord is righteous, for I have rebelled against his command. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my shame. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity. I have called to my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and my elders perished in the city while they sought food to restore their strength for themselves. O Lord, I am in great distress. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is overturned within me, for I have been very rebellious. This is true confession, class. It doesn't wipe over. It doesn't seek to minimize the agony of chastisement and affliction. It's real. You might say, but now doesn't Job tell us that when misery comes, we're not to think of a specific sin? Yes, in the individual case. As in Job, when a person is personally afflicted. But there are times when the individual person knows that he's being chastised and afflicted because of a sin. And we've all suffered from that. We all know when we goofed badly or really went willfully on the wrong way that we had to suffer for it painfully one way or another. Oh yes, we all know that that's the case too. But when great calamity strikes, it doesn't behoove a single one of us to point a finger at the other. This is what we had from Job to say, there's a great sin in your life. But in the case of Jerusalem, the whole community knew it. It wasn't for anyone to say, in any way, I have not been rebellious. But we'll go to chapter 2. Jerusalem, the afflicted city. If the emphasis on the first one was the lonely one in hunger and pain, with no comforter. Jerusalem, the afflicted city. And that verse, in the first 8 verses, stress, carry out that thought that we had in verse 1, in chapter 1, verse 5 and 21. The Lord has brought this great affliction. We are in the hands of God. Again, note the first 2 lines of chapter 2. The contrast from what the children of Israel could have had. In the wilderness, they had the Lord covering them with a cloud of shade, with a cloud of fire to give them light, and a cloud of a shade to give them protection from the sun. Now he's covered them with a cloud of anger instead of loving care. That's anger. And with that cloud of anger over them, he has cast them from heaven and he has cast from heaven to earth the glory of Israel, and he has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. The Lord has swallowed up. He has not spared. In his wrath he has thrown down. Verse 3, in fierce anger he has cut off. In the last part of verse 3, he has burned Jacob. He has burned in Jacob like a flaming fire consuming round about. Maybe he's talking again about the time that the fire burnt when the first rebellion took place in the camp. You remember way back in Exodus 16? And there was a burning in the camp? And we read that in Numbers 11. And there was a burning on the edge of the camp. This time there's been a burning right in the middle of the whole city. A burning, consuming, not just on the outskirts, but from the center. There's been a burning all the way. He has bent his bow like an enemy. He has set his right hand as an adversary. In the last part of verse 4, he has poured out his wrath like fire. The Lord has become like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. His palaces destroyed his stronghold and multiplied mourning and moaning. He has violently treated his tabernacle. God is the one who destroyed his own dwelling place. Here's this acknowledgement of God's sovereignty even over these temple burners. God destroyed his tabernacle. Verse 6. He has destroyed the appointed meeting place. He's no longer got a place for meeting his people. He's cast them out. So he's thrown the meeting place overboard. He has caused to be forgotten the appointed feast and Sabbath in Zion. He has despised the king and the priest in the indignation of his anger. The Lord has rejected his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary. The Lord determined, verse 8, the Lord determined to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. You see, as he looks at the city, a cloud of anger. As he looks at the city, he sees the people that are protected, swallowed up by anger and fire. As he looks around about him, what does he see? A temple burnt. The hand of God. He sees the altar pulverized at the hand of God. He sees no one around at all to keep a feast to bring a sacrifice. God eliminated it all. That what God had given for the praise of his worship, I mean for his praise to worship, God now takes away. Amos talks about that terrible famine that was to be in the land in chapter 7. And the people will be hungering for the word. Well, that happened, you know. No priest, no prophet, no altar, no house of worship. God has done this. Then he goes on to say that this affliction by the Lord indeed brings great agony of affliction. Oh, the agony when God says it's terrible to fall into the hands of the living God. This is, as I read it in verses 9, there's that physical agony with the gates sinking into the ground, the kings and palaces among the nations. When the law is no more, and the prophets have no visions from the Lord, and the elders of the daughters of Zion sit on the ground silent. Then my eyes fail for tears. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is poured out on the earth. I'm reading verse 11. Because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. When I look at all this devastation at God's hand, the agony when the little ones faint, an infant faint in the street. You ever seen little children so ravishly hungry that they're just about to claw you to pieces? I've been in a few of the Japanese orphanages right after the Second World War. I have seen children so hungry that when the chaplain in our outfit heard about an orphanage up in the mountains, inland from straight east of Nara, and I was motor sergeant, but I helped him a lot as an assistant. And so when we got paid every week, we'd be payments there, because some of these guys would blow everything that they got the first 3 hours they had, and then they'd be without for a year. I mean, for a month, you know. So our captain, for a while, decided to pay every week. But anyway, the day of payment, we had great big boxes set in our PX for candies and everything else like this, and then we'd take them to these little kiddies, because we had heard about that orphanage by 200 children. And these little children were just skin and bone. The parents that's killed, that disappears, a little waste have been picked up in the bombed out city. Hunger. Oh, it was terrible. Well, and when the little ones faint, that's agony. But proceed. When mothers say to their mother, where's grain and wine? Mother, give me something to eat and to drink. As they faint like a wounded man in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out on their mother's bosom, to have the babies die in their mother's breast. Starved to death. How shall I admonish you? To what shall I compare you, O daughter of Zion? To what childlike in you as I comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? Your ruin is as vast as the sea. Who can heal you? You're unhealable. The agony of a person when the doctor says, incurably sick. And then when you know that there's no hope to relieve your agony, to relieve your pain. This is the agony of Jerusalem in the hand of a God of anger. It's terrible to fall into the hand of a living God. Your prophets have seen for you false and foolish visions, and they have not exposed your iniquity. Yes, just think back, you having false leaders. The agony of being led in the wrong way. And the agony now of having the neighbors come across and say, oh, in verse 15, a perfection of beauty is joy to the whole earth. Note the rhetorical question mark. To be taunted when in misery instead of somebody to help you, than to be laughed at. All your enemies have opened their mouth wide against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth, and they say, we have swallowed her up. The Lord has done what he has purposed. Verse 17. He has accomplished his word, which he commanded from the days of old. He has thrown down without sparing, and he has caused the enemy to rejoice over you. He has exalted the might of your adversary. God is the source of agony. The Lord did it without sparing. Now, in the midst of all this agony, verse 19, starting at verse 18, arise, the heart cried out to the Lord, O woe of the daughter of Zion, let your tears run down like a river day and night. Let your eyes have no rest. Arise, cry aloud in the night. Pour out your heart like water before the presence of the Lord. Lift up your hands to him for the life of your little ones, who are faint because of hunger at the head of this every street. See, O Lord, look. Pray anyway. Plead anyway. Intercede. Never can it be said, this is not the time to pray. Arise. Don't just weep. As you weep, pray. Intercede. As you see these poor little children starving, there's only one who finally can have, who has the final, the rest of the thing finally in hand. It's the Lord, God Almighty. Pray. Arise. Cry aloud. Pray. Oh Lord, look. Oh Lord, look. The little ones who were born healthy, the middle of verse 20. On the ground, in verse 21, on the ground in the streets lie young and old. My virgins and my young men have fallen by the sword. Thou hast slain them. Thou hast slaughtered them. Thou didst cause in the day of an appointed feast my terrors on every side. And there was no one who escaped or survived in the day of the Lord's anger. Those whom I bore and reared, my enemy annihilated them. In the midst of this agony, in the midst of this sin, still pray. Still pray. That's the point of that last part of chapter 2. Now in chapter 3, Jeremiah more specifically becomes the voice of the agonizing people under affliction in agony. Note that in verses 1 to 18, it is either I or he. Those of you that have the New American Standard Bible, look right down the column there. Verse 1, it is, I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath, I have seen. And then, he, in verse 3, it's about the fourth word, he. And in verse 4, it's my. And in the last part of that verse, it's he. And I just go right on down. And you will notice that it's I, me, or he. He has done this. I see it. It is my affliction. Jeremiah, as I stated here now, becomes the voice of the agonizing city. I have become a laughingstock. I have seen the rod of his wrath, verse 1, in verse 14. I have become a laughingstock to all my people, verse 17. I have forgotten happiness. I say, my strength is gone, verse 18. But he, is the one who held the rod of wrath. He has given me and made me walk, verse 2. He has turned his hand repeatedly all day, verse 3. He causes flesh and skin to waste. What's the point of this? Jeremiah realizes how this is a tremendous encounter between God and him, between God and his people. It's a personal encounter. It's a he me. It's an I, him. This is something intensely personal. It's between living personalities. I'm getting to that concept again of the covenant. The covenant being expressed in curse. He, me. Instead of in blessing. He, me. Here is the personal expression of the agony of the individual who knows what it is to be under the covenant curse. When God
deals with him personally. Now we'll go on to the next section. And there we have a lot of the I again, too. It begins there with, I have hope. Beginning at verse 19, remember my affliction and my wandering, the wormwood and bitterness. Remember my, surely my soul remembers and is bowed down within me. This I recall to my mind. Therefore I have hope. Therefore I have hope. And as soon as he begins to really get into that personal interchange and realizing that, the curse of the covenant is terrible. But as he begins to really get into this intimate personal interchange, that becomes the occasion for finding hope. And that becomes the occasion of saying the Lord's loving kindness is indeed never ceased. God's chesed. The covenant bond continues to be a living reality. His compassions never fail. His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. This passage is, like so many others, far too often is lifted out of context. This faithfulness of God that is seen. Then, when a man, seeing the awful results of sin, realizing the agony of God's justice on sin, experiencing the depths of the anguish of God's justice on sin in the midst of that, then to see God, but the fact that I'm living and that I can still have this interchange, great is thy faithfulness. God is still my hope. It never gets too dark, in other words. It never becomes too bitter. But God is there. He keeps. He upholds. He sustains. In the midst of mercy, in the midst of wrath, remember mercy. Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 2. Remember how he prayed it? Jeremiah says, here it is. As Habakkuk prayed, so Jeremiah confessed. It was a reality. God did not forget mercy in the midst of all that grief. And so the Lord, verse 24 to 26, is my portion. He is my all. I dwelt on that thought for just a bit yesterday in chapel. Because he, after all, is the key to all in this thought. I have hope. I have hope. And the Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. It is good that he waits silently for the way, for the salvation of the Lord. So when the Lord strikes, sit back and wait. Yes, you pray. But when things are indeed beyond your hand, look to him. See his faithfulness. Plead his mercy. And wait. The Lord will answer. We're starting now in verse 27 on. In chapter 3. It is good to bear affliction. The affliction of the youth of former sin. Verses 27 through 38. The blessing of affliction. You know, if I never got struck, I wouldn't know, have a foretaste of what eternal hell would be like. If I never endured pain in this world, I'd never know the agony of a Christless eternity. Can't compare them. Never. Impossible to compare them. But nevertheless, is a taste. A suggestion, a pointer. It is good to suffer, to bear the affliction of my youth, when in youth. It is good to know that he causes grief, verses 32. For the Lord will not reject forever, verse 31. For if he causes grief, then he will have compassion according to his abundant loving kindness. For he does not afflict willingly or grieve the sons of men to crush under his feet all the prisoners of the land, to deprive a man of justice in the presence of the Most High, to defraud a man of his lawsuit. Oh no. God doesn't do it just for the cause sake. He does it for his people's sake. And so in Psalm 119, it is good that I have been afflicted. Oh, I'll read that in chapel tomorrow morning. Chastisement is good. The Lord loves those whom he chastises. He chastises those whom he loves. If our load was always a load of roses,
And if our beds are always beautiful warm water beds in the winter and cool water beds in the summer, we might indeed wonder if we were children of the Lord. No, it is good. It is good to be afflicted. Because that makes me turn from self and turn to the Lord. Remember, Jeremiah comes to this after he has gotten that personal encounter. As a covenant man, that personal encounter with the Lord. Then he sees the goodness of the Lord, and then he sees God knows best after all. He does. He knows best. He knows how to make my foolishness pay off for good in my life. He knows how to make my sin pay good dividend in the long run. Not dividend of sin, but dividend of mercy and grace. Ah, it is good to be afflicted. Painful though it is at the time. So let us examine ourselves, 39 to 42. Let us examine and probe our ways, and let us return to the Lord. I'm reading verse 40 particularly. We will lift up our hearts and hands toward the God of heaven. We have transgressed and rebelled. Thou hast not pardoned. Thou hast covered thyself with anger and hast pursued us. Thou hast slain and hast not spared. Thou hast covered thyself with a cloud. That may be. Yes, yes, let us examine ourselves and see that God has every reason to hide himself from us. But note the thou and me from verse 48 on. My eyes this, but thou, O Lord. And there again is that interaction that when he again considers, when he examines his own ways, oh, it's awful, in verses 39 to 44. But that self-examination again leads him to turn his eyes to God, and he gets back into that personal encounter of the eyes out. It begins by, I weep until the Lord looks down. I cry to him out of the pit, verse 55. And then the assurance of prayer heard from 56 to 66. That eyes out. The absolute assurance of prayer heard, even on the ash heap. On bed of affliction, in the midst of that crucible of temptation. And class, God hears. And God helps. Courage, then ye weary. You know that song? Jesus lives and Jesus leads. Though the way be dreary, still the faithful shepherd lives. Jesus lives and Jesus leads. All the bread he ever broke, still to us he breaketh. All the words he ever spoke, still to us he speaketh. Jesus lives and Jesus leads. Courage, then he willing. Oh, it was a song that came to mean a lot to me. Especially 13 years in Australia, there were times that he really felt alone, all alone. It's amazing yet what the difference in cultures are between one nation and another. But I must frankly confess that I felt that aloneness in a man when I served in a church in West Michigan. To be a friend to all means to be no close friend to any. That's right. Unless you're convinced that you've got a right to single out two or three of the congregation as your special friend. I know I had a fellow minister in Australia that insisted I was local. But I had the experience of my first congregation in West Michigan. That when some people who had been very close friends with my predecessor wanted to be very close friends with me, I found out in the first couple of weeks that I was there that some of the people were just sitting back to see if I was going to become the buddy of the well-healed. I didn't know they were that well-healed at first. And I said no to that. And the Lord gave us a blessed ministry there. It was very lonely at times. Very lonely. Thank God for a doctor who was an elder in a church down the road. 6-7 miles down the road, there were 4 churches in the city of Zealand. And our family doctor, an elder, felt too that he couldn't become special friends with any of the people there. Now and then at 11 o'clock at night, he'd come down the road, switch off his lights, pull in through the back of the parking lot, park his car behind the garage, and sneak in. We'd sit and have a good chat from 11 to 1 in the morning. Yes, because he had those same lonelinesses. But again, as you examine yourself and as you pray, God always provides. Because there was a number of times that Dr. John walked in at just the right time. It seemed like when Brother John had needed help, it was exactly the time that George was just wishing that he could let his hair down to a brother.
There
have been amazing times. There have been amazing ways that God has heard and answered. God hears, God answers, regardless of where you are. I suppose the worst time that I really had was when my first 2 weeks in the Army. Having been the oldest one at home, at times having 110, 120 men under my thumb. Fruit pickers, almond shakers, truck drivers, tractor drivers. And I was running the farm for the family, and my word was it. And suddenly I was just a number, a buck private. Get! Oh, that's right, I'm a private. That part of it. That's swearing. I wake up in the morning and felt like I had an inbuilt recording. I was just ready to repeat everything I'd heard. As I went to sleep the night before with these half-drunk guys coming in. And I mentioned before, and you get overseas, and the wretched loneliness, and one after the other goes off the deep end. And these cute little Japanese girls standing there offering all their friendships and warmth. I tell you, God answers prayer at times like that. But you got to pray. That's what Jeremiah is telling us here, too. Chapter 4, the tragedies of the affliction of Jerusalem. From riches to ashes, the first 10 verses. From riches to ashes. Jerusalem once was as a jewel, verse 7. But now she's worse than Sodom, verse 6. Can you imagine? Well supplied Jerusalem with food, verse 10. Now compassionate mothers boiling their children to eat because of hunger. That's from riches to ashes. There's a tremendous contrast. And the unbelievable source of all this, yes, God accomplishes his wrath. 11, 16. It's the sin of kings, of prophets and priests, verses 12 and 13. Your eyes can't believe it. Again, is he backing down from the high point of chapter 3? No. God doesn't answer immediately. He shows us the way. But the misery remains for the time being. 70 years of it they're going to have. Yes, you may rejoice, Edom. Now is your time to laugh. Laugh, Edom, if that's indeed what you want to do. And then in chapter 5, Jerusalem becomes the agonizing suppliant. Oh, God, remember our inheritance, that which is rightfully ours, chapter 5. Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our reproach. If chapter 4 again takes us to the misery, chapter 5 again takes us to see the God, sovereign in justice, sovereign in judgment, a God who makes the covenant people into orphans, verse 3. Because fathers have sinned, is there no blessing? Yes, there is. O God, verse 19, thou dost rule forever. Thy throne is from generation to generation. Notice that statement of the acknowledgement of the sovereignty of God. But why that plea, ending with a seeming impatient note? Why dost thou forget us forever? Why dost thou forsake us so long? Restore us to thee, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. God, you're going to have to do it. God, you're going to have to do it. Restore us, and then we'll be restored. Hosea said, heal, and we'll be healed. Jeremiah said, cleanse us, and we will be cleansed. The prophets were great believers and preachers of our sovereign God. And a helpless man, really helpless, but not forgotten. Although he asked the question, verse 22, unless thou hast utterly rejected us and art exceedingly angry with us, unless. I have serious doubts that little conjunction is properly translated here in verse 22. Some of you that have another translation, what is the conjunction you have in the last verse, the first word? What do you have there, Ron? Ron?
I have aren't exceedingly angry.
And art thou exceeding? And how about?
Wouldst thou reject us completely?
Wouldst thou?
See,
wouldst thou? The Berkeley people have read that as a rhetorical question.
Okay. Yes, they have, unless.
The ASV. Unless you have. Anyone? Anybody else got another translation?
Thou art very
well against us. Is that the last verse?
But
they say but, they make it adversative. And the others make it kind of subjunctive. And what does the Chinese do?
They said, are you one of those that's deserted us? And you're so angry with us.
But what is the conjunction? How does it start there?
But.
But you have. No, I think that I have to go to Berkeley this time. I've done that before. I think it's a rhetorical question that we have here. Wouldst thou utterly reject us? Art thou exceedingly angry with us? In the final analysis, no. No, thou wouldst not utterly reject us. No. Kirby?
It seems to me that, if what I hear, it seems like you're painting the picture of the complete captivity as being one of dismal gloom and despair. And I made a mistake about read some men that painted it almost the other way, where they say there was a time of real prosperity. And one since they really grew and prospered, not only agriculturally, but as merchants.
Oh, you're talking about the people in over there, way out in the east, in Babylon. Yes, they eventually became very rich. We're talking about Jerusalem, the city of God, the symbol of the nation of God's people, the covenant people and the land. We're not talking about the remnant now and the eventual outcome of all this. No, we're talking about the actual grief and the actual misery at the time that Jerusalem was wiped. God's city was wiped. What comes out of it eventually? That's something different. And Ezekiel gives us a view of that. That's true. Shall we have our break?